This is part one of a two-part interview with Sean Blanchfield of Page Fair. In this part, we discuss the history of Page Fair, the online advertising industry, ad blocking, and where Page Fair fits into this. And then in part two, we discuss some of the technical issues of how Page Fair works and its ad exchange. I'm joined today by Sean Blanchfield, co-founder of Demonware and Page Fair. Thanks for joining me, Sean.
Thanks, Brian. It's a pleasure.
Can you tell me a little bit about the two companies?
Sure. Well, Demonware, rewinding back to 2003 for this one, I was doing a PhD in Trinity College Dublin in distributed systems. And my area was basically file sharing or trying to anonymize peer-to-peer networks. So that's what I was studying. But at the same time, another research group in the same department had essentially spun out as a company called Havoc, and they were doing physics middleware for video games and for some movies, like they did some of the special effects in The Matrix. So we were just dead jealous of them. And one day we tried to figure out, well, you know, is there a way that we could apply this networking stuff and create a middleware product for video games? Now, at that time, we were addicts of Counter-Strike. I'm not sure, maybe you're familiar with that game, Brian?
First-person shooter.
So we used to play that at 5 p.m. every day. And
until 5 a.m.?
Yeah, sometimes. You know. It was a very hard-working computer lab. But we thought, well, maybe we can apply this technology and make multiplayer games easier to make for video game studios. And the whole thing was based on this idea that multiplayer was going to become popular. Right then, it was still something you basically did on PCs. It was popular with students, but it wasn't mainstream yet. So 2003, we set out, we started this company. I dropped out of my PhD. I was working with another student who I had a previous business with at the time during college, Dylan Collins. And we raised some venture capital money in Ireland in 2003, right after the dot-com bubble. I don't know how we managed it, but someone gave us $500,000, and we got going. And it took quite a while. It took 18 months before we made our first sale. But then things began to move quickly. And before we knew what was happening, we were working with basically all of the big video games publishers in the world, apart from EA. So we were working on Guitar Hero, Call of Duty, Splinter Cell, a bunch of racing games. So it was pretty good fun. 4.5 years into the company, Activision bought us. They were our biggest client. So that was really exciting. And so that was Demonware. It's still going. It's about 200 people split between Dublin, Vancouver in Canada, not Seattle, and Shanghai. And it still runs Call of Duty and various other games. Call of Duty is by far the biggest one. Obviously, it's I think not last year, but for several years previous to that, it was the biggest media launch of all time, breaking new records every single year. So typically in that game, like even about now, so Irish time, it's 4:15 right now. It's not quite peak, but in a few hours' time, there'll be about 3 million concurrent players in that game. So we ran all the servers that managed all of that stuff, as well as all the peer-to-peer algorithms to send traffic between those. So it's quite a giant infrastructure that handles, I'm not sure what it is right now, somewhere in the region of 50,000 requests per second, which is all transactional. Yeah, so that was fun. I left Demonware 18 months after the acquisition, and I started doing new ventures. I teamed up with a former classmate, Brian McDonald. We tried a bunch of things. Some of them worked, some of them didn't. We didn't get any great successes during the first couple of years, but we had a lot of fun. And then in 2012, we decided to create our own incubator in Dublin called Scalefront. And the idea there basically was to say, hang on, we're technology entrepreneurs. We've had some luck in the past. We've had like some, you know, successful companies, created jobs and a bit of wealth. But we've also had a lot of failures. And we thought, well, let's do the math on this. How long will it take before, you know, we have our next success? We thought, well, okay, you've got to try a lot of things. You know, maybe we spend another 3 years trying different things and then we find one that works. Then you start that company, you spend maybe 5 years in it. If it goes well, you get bought. You spend a few years probably locked into the new company. before you know what's happening, you're actually on a 10-year cycle as an entrepreneur, which means you've probably got about 3 bets in your entire career that you can place, which isn't an awful lot of chances at the roulette wheel, really. So we decided that we needed a different strategy. That's what the incubator was about. The idea was to take every business concept that we'd had while sipping a pint of Guinness or whatever, which we did a lot of, and we'd been taking notes for several years on business ideas. So we had 50 at that time, and we thought, well, let's try and parallelize this and do them all. Basically, throw a lot of can I curse on this show, Brian? Or
no problem.
Yeah, throw a lot of shit at the wall and see what sticks. And there's the lean startup movement, you know, which is trying to apply a lot of like lean manufacturing rules or to business development. It looks a lot like agile for startup strategy. So we took that stuff, that entire framework and methodology, and tried to apply it into a parallelized framework. Put our own resources behind it to start a small team here, and started crunching through these ideas, trying to identify quick ways to do market research, quick ways to do a little MVP. You know, we got through all 50 in 1 year. 25 got thrown out really, really quick, you know, just on the face of it, back of envelope calculation about the amount of money you could make. You know, you can throw out a lot of ideas that way. And the other 25 got some proper research done on them in terms of, you know, who's the customers? Do the customers have money? Can we get meetings with customers or market to them, or, you know, that kind of stuff. We launched 5 things, and one of them began to really work. And that was Pagefair. And when it really began to work, we were thinking, well, we've got no choice. We've got to shut down that incubator and all work will work for Pagefair. So Pagefair spinned out of Scalefront last year during the summer. And we all jumped into it. And it's been going great ever since. And I think it's an interesting process. You know, we took an engineering approach to trying to figure out the look of the entrepreneur. And so far it's going really well, because when you throw 50 things at the wall, the one that sticks is probably pretty good, right? And in a way, I guess we manufactured a bit of luck just from a pure, selfish point of view. Pagefair is a really strong business. It's got a lot of really cool things going for it. It's got customers who really need it, customers who come to us. We don't need to really spend money trying to market at them. They're finding us, you know. A bunch of really cool things. So we're really excited.
So what did you have last summer when you decided to spin it out? What was it that was enough to determine it would stand on its own?
Yeah, so when we started out with this, talk about the actual genesis of it. We had a game called Utopia. We still have it, actually. Kind of on the side. And this is a text-based, massively multiplayer role-playing game that's been going since 1998, believe it or not. So it's changed hands a few times, and it ended up in our hands, and we were running that. We basically acquired it from a company that another guy, my old co-founder, started. And Bran and I were trying to turn it around. We thought, how do we make this make money? And we saw that there was a big discrepancy between the number of page views we were getting and the number of ad views we were getting. And we were scratching our heads trying to wonder, well, how come there's a 30% gap there, right? You know, for every page view, we should be getting some ad views. But, you know, we thought, well, maybe, like, everyone's using Adblock. And this is 2010, right? So we were thinking, no, can people really be that geeky? I mean, we know about Adblock, but do all these gamers know about Adblock? So we came up with a test, a bit of JavaScript, to go and figure it out, plugged it into the game, and had it reporting back into Google Analytics, and determined, yeah, it was ad blocking. So that was a real kind of punch in the stomach, right? So it's a game, doesn't make a ton of money, you know. We were trying to rescue it, and a full 1/3 of the players were blocking the only revenue stream that existed in this free to play game, you know, and they're supposed to be the loyal fans. So this was one of the first things that came off the pile of business ideas when we went into Scalefront. But we said, okay, we need to not just do this because of passion. We need to be objective and look at it and say, just as from a business point of view, where are the risks here and what do we need to figure out? And one of the big ones was to answer the question, was Utopia just an extreme example? or is ad blocking actually getting pretty big out there on the web? So we wanted to be able to measure this broadly and just see, is ad blocking actually a big problem? Right, there's a lot of money in ads, right? $48 billion going to be spent on display advertising online this year, right? We wanted to know what percentage of that, you know, ad blocking would have represented. And then the other question was, you know, can we get in touch with publishers? Like, we're not really from the publishing industry or advertising industry. So we're wondering, like, well, are we going to have to spend like $1,000 on advertising to get one converted active publisher using our system? Or, you know, are they going to be able to come to us, or can we come up with smart ways to engage with publishers? So those are our two things. We want to know market size and can we basically get publishers onto the platform? And the moment that changed was at the start of March last year. So we've been plugging away at Pagefair, and it was up there and live as an analytics tool for ad blocking that any website could just grab the JavaScript snippet and put it on, get real-time analytics on ad blocking on their own website. That was our overture, right? Really simple product, but it was testing for us how big ad blocking was on the web and whether or not we could basically get a relationship going with web publishers. At the start of March, actually during my bachelor party in Dublin, there was about 20 of us at various states of inebriation, our phones started going off and all of our automated alarms started firing server alerts at us. And it turned out that we'd kind of gone viral. One of the sites that was using us, Destructoid, is a very popular gaming blog and news site. So, you know, it's mainly focused on indie games, got a good loyal audience. The guy who runs that site, runs the business, had written a blog post talking about how ad blocking was affecting his business. And it was revealing his stats that he'd measured through us and doing it with screenshots from us and referencing us back. So basically, he had 46% of his users had ad block installed on his website. And he was basically appealing to it as basically something like almost half of our users block ads. What next for Destructoid, right? And it was very, very emotive. And he published that. It went crazy on Reddit, Slashdot, and Hacker News simultaneously on the same day during my bachelor party. And 200 websites signed up with us that day and started sending traffic to us. So you got to remember, like, because we're doing analytics, every single page view on every website sends an event through us as well, right? So it's a lot of traffic. And we were still in a very scrappy startup mode. So, we don't reveal the identity of websites that work with us unless they have already revealed their identity, like Destructoid. So I won't name the website, but let's say a very popular website that people use for torrenting things signed up and totally knocked us offline. And that's what that happened. So it was a very, very interesting Sunday morning trying to put things back together again. But it's one of those good problems. And on the Monday, when the hangover had slightly subsided and everything was working again, that's when we realized, holy crap, right? We set out in this path to figure out if we could get publishers to engage with us and if the problem was big. We'd answered both questions.
So you've clearly shown that ad blockers are very, very popular. Because, like you said, when the role-playing game, it was a very geeky audience. And I've been using ad blockers for 5 or 6 years or even longer. And I've been encouraging people to use them and no one ever wanted to. And I was surprised when I was preparing for this that I saw it's become enormous, like on Firefox, something like 20 million downloads, and on Chrome I can just see plus 10 million for one ad blocker and plus 10 million for another. I don't think it'll show me again until it hits 50 million or something. So aside from, let's say, Destructoid and Utopia, what are the general percentages that you feel are out there in ad blockers?
Yeah, so what I can tell you, I can take this from a few different angles, right? By the time this podcast goes live, I guess we'll already have released our new report. So under embargo with you, Brian, I'll release some numbers, if that's
no problem.
Okay.
So we're recording this on September the 6th, and I'm expecting to post it sometime in early to mid-October. So yeah. I think nothing will be public until then, so we're fine.
Be fine. So across our network, we've got about 1,100 websites online with us now. We're processing their traffic. About 1 in 5 ads are blocked on that network currently, right? So that's a really big sample of websites. It's a lot of traffic. That represents about, if I recall correctly, about 400 million unique users per month. Big sample.
And right. You'd say the 1,100 websites are not any one niche. It's a pretty broad sampling.
It's spread, but you know, I will put my hands up and say it's got to be skewed as well. These are the websites that are concerned about ad blocking and therefore, you know, Googled the problem and found us. So that's one data point. If we break that down by site category, you get a little bit more insight. For gaming sites, that's the worst, right? It's always over 30% for games websites now, right? Really high. Right, so, and that's pretty much come out of nowhere in the last few years. Technology websites will normally be about 25%. And then the rest is a little kind of surprising. Right? It's still high in a lot of other places. Like entertainment websites tend to be in the high teens. Right? So something's reviewing movies, for instance. Business websites end up at around 15%. And I like to say that, you know, that's surprising at the start when you picture, you know, an old gray-haired man in a suit. You're wondering, is that guy really using ad blocker? But, you know, you factor in all the hipsters and hoodies in Starbucks drinking their lattes on their MacBooks, programming their next business, it kind of comes into focus, right?
Or also, so, I mean, in the U.S., you've got people watching the stock market a lot more because 401ks, college funds are all tied into the business side of things.
Yeah, of course. And then at the bottom end of the scale, actually not quite the bottom, but just if you take some really broad content like a news website or a TV station, something like that, then it tends to be just slightly north of 10%, right? So that's still way higher than you'd expect for something that's just basically general interest. The low end is like what we've seen, sites that are focused purely on fashion or gardening. You know, they're not very high, all right, about 5%. Now, there's a more interesting way to look at this, we've realized. You can talk about site category, but behind that is the kind of person who goes to those kinds of categories. And a cleaner correlation for ad blocking, basically, is how young the person is, right? So, you know, Brian, you said that you've been using Adblock for 5 years, and I think I remember I first heard about it in 2004 when it came out. And before that, I remember in the late 90s when I had a modem, and maybe you did the same, rewriting my hosts file so that ads wouldn't load, right? So ad blocking has been around for quite a long time among geeks.
As I think about it, I probably was using it before I even moved to the US. I think I was using it back in Hungary, so it would be 2006, 2007. But yeah, I certainly didn't know about it as early as 2004, I think.
And it was on Firefox then, and you know, popular with Firefox users. And that's fine, right? That's pretty much, that's the geeks. That's the hardcore old guard, right? They're in the middle, still ad blocking.
I still use Firefox.
But, you know, since 2009, things have begun to change, right? Chrome's come out, right? And Chrome's been stealing market share, not just off Firefox, but in particular off Internet Explorer. So the kinds of people who used to be using Internet Explorer, which wasn't you, it wasn't me, right, are using Chrome now. And on Chrome, it's just dead easy to install a browser extension. And so that's one effect. You've also got to think about, you know, the people who've been growing up. You know, basically people under 25 have grown up with web browsers, right? That wasn't quite the case for me, you know. The web for me started at the start of college. Just normal people, you know, under the age of 25, know what a browser extension is. And they probably know what the most popular one is on every browser, which is Adblock.
Yeah.
Right? So it's just, that's where it's coming from. The second group is basically just young people. So if you've got movie websites, you know, the games websites is an interesting one. The games websites have young audiences that are also geeky. So they're slammed from both sides with ad blocking. But, you know, for any website, basically, I can ask the owner now about their demographics and normally give them a pretty clear prediction on what their ad blocking rate is going to be. It's higher with guys than girls, that's another piece, but it's not that much higher, right? It's about 50% higher with guys than girls, if I remember correctly, but you know, still, that just means that ad blocking among women is just needs to catch up a little bit. It's still actually really high. for people under 25. Once you go over 25, it falls off a cliff and it's down to just the geeks again, right? So it's a demographic group kind of just growing up with Adblock coming through.
And that group, of course, is getting larger.
Yeah. And you know, when the current 25-year-olds grow up, they'll be in their 30s, and they'll be replaced by people who've been ad-blocking since they were 12. And it's likely to continue to grow from what we can see.
In one of the blog posts on your site, it was saying that the feeling was when YouTube introduced pre-video ads, that was what really kicked ad-blocking into high gear.
Yeah. So we've done a little bit of surveying around this, user attitudes to ads, and Adblock Plus, actually, the leading Adblock plugin, did a survey 2 years ago as well. They tried to figure out, you know, okay, there's ad blocking, but ad blocking is indiscriminate. You install it, it blocks everything. That's really, in my opinion, the problem, right? It punishes the good and the bad equally. But so they tried to drill into that and say, well, what are the attitudes to different kinds of ads? And we recently did the same thing. And it's stark, really. You know, even users of Adblock plugins don't really have a problem with certain kinds of ads. So long as the ads don't get in the way of what you're trying to do, break the user experience. Pre-roll ads, which is the technical name for those YouTube ads, they do, right? It's not what you went there to see. And so if you think about the typical 16-year-old who watches YouTube instead of television, right? They know their way around their internet browser, which is Chrome, right? And they're like frustrated by seeing the same pre-roll ad for the fifth time in the same day, and they're kind of like, you know, just let me get rid of this. Probably down there in the comments underneath the video, if you can actually read that stuff, there's someone in there saying, install Adblock to get rid of the ads. And that's where it's spreading from. Right? Primarily, people are hearing about it from friends. That's the number one source, someone they know in real life. And then it's spreading basically through like websites, comment sections, that kind of thing.
And even if you just go to show me the most popular extensions,
yeah.
It's there. But what I noticed on Chrome was generally popular, it wasn't shown, but if you then rank it by downloads, it's at the top. It almost felt like Chrome was trying to...
pushing it down the list there, it would seem. Yeah,
I've been wondering.
Yeah, because apparently most popular isn't just a question of how popular it is.
It's how popular it is with Chrome and the makers.
Yeah, but it leads to a really, like, frankly, ironic situation for Google. You know, and I feel bad for them. The Google ads aren't even, by and large, the worst ones out there, right? They're not the ones selling, like, crazy weight loss pills or, you know, they're not inappropriate. You know, the content is, you know, never adult or gambling-related or anything like that. It's always pretty clean stuff. But Google's browser has made it available to people who would never have considered it before. YouTube is making it nearly a practical necessity. And there's lots of rumors that, you know... they were whitelisted. AdWords, Google AdWords were whitelisted with Adblock Plus last year. Right, so you search for something on Google.com with Adblock Plus installed, you'll still see the search advertising. Right, this is a program that Adblock Plus have in order to try to be constructive, you know, and say, hang on, some ads are bad, some ads are good, we'll let the good ones back in. But they normally charge a fee for, you know, letting the good ads back, right? A service fee, right? They're trying to promote this concept, right? But and in fact, we're working with them also, right? But yeah, I don't know. It's quite possible. No one will reveal the actual numbers or if there is a number. But there's been a lot of speculation that Google might actually be paying them, which would mean that Google's contributing in a third very bizarre way to ad blocking, which is coming to eat its lunch. At the same time, Google's own hands are tied, I think, because it's a public company that's based in advertising, right? It doesn't want to. If I was Google, I wouldn't want to engage too heavily pointing out how big ad blocking was to my shareholders. And I would also want to get rid of it. But I'd be afraid that doing something like banning ad block from Chrome would be somewhat evil, it being the most popular user plugin in the world, right? So it's a bit crazy. I think, Google... Google doesn't deserve this, you know, but they're in a very strange position.
No, but I have noticed that one of the ad blockers, I can't remember whether it's Adblock or Adblock Plus, they give you the option to show non-intrusive ads, but of course you can disable that.
Yeah.
Are those then the ads that the likes of Google will present to you at the top of the list?
That's the acceptable advertising program. And
it seemed pretty easy to block those as well if you wanted to with one of them.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're pretty upfront with it. Yeah. They just basically allow what they've audited as acceptable ads, mm-hmm. right? Which, you know, they've polled their users and everyone, not everyone, but nearly everyone was happy to see, say, text ads and static advertising. That was clearly labeled. Right, so, you know, they let some ads back by default and you can turn it off again. You know, it's a strange thing. It's a lot about defaults, you know? Do you know that? Did you ever hear about that thing with, you know, organ donor cards, right? And in some countries, you got to check the box. In other countries, I mean, check the box if you want to participate. In other countries, you have to check the box not to participate. I think Denmark or something. You have to check the box if you don't want, on your driver's license, you know, if you don't want to be an organ donor. And participation rates are crazy. Basically, it's all dictated by the default, right? Whatever you do, like 5% of people will check the box, regardless of whether it means you become an organ donor or not. And it's the same with ad blocking, right? It's like the problem with ad block is you install it once because there are some really bad, shitty ads on some website. That makes sense, right? There's a lot of really bad ads out there. But it works by blocking everything by default, everywhere, good and bad, right? And anything you do to try and ask the user to make like a special exception for a website is just never going to work except with, in our experience, a fraction of 1% of the people who see it, right? So with the acceptable advertising program, what they've done is they've flipped the default. And for ads that meet a certain criteria around the format, like they're not intrusive, they don't intrude on the user experience, they flipped the default, that's all. And the option's still there, you can turn it off, but it's just, they're shown by default. And that's an incredibly powerful thing.
But isn't there the issue, though, that if the person, like in my own case, if I deliberately don't want ads, even if I'm willing to look, or not, let's say, look at it, but I'm willing to have non-intrusive ads presented to me, I'm still not going to click on them because I'm not interested in ads.
Ah, yes. It's not true. It's not true, Brian.
Okay. Yeah. What are the numbers showing?
You know, a lot of people say this, and they think it's, you know, and maybe it's true for you, right?
Yeah.
You're a pretty savvy person. You probably don't click on any ads. Even if you weren't an ad blocker, you wouldn't, right? Except by mistake. Or maybe, you know, occasionally you might click on an ad, but you didn't really think of it as an ad because it just happened to be a classified recommendation, maybe on Craigslist or God knows what, you know, that was actually relevant to you. So if in the rare cases you actually clicked on it, you probably wouldn't actually have thought of it as an ad in the first place. Mm. The ads are the stuff that sticks out as like a sore thumb, right? And you don't click on that. Now, what we see with PageFair ads, so we show ads to ad blockers. We show really ultra polite ads to ad blockers, and we allow people to turn them off if they don't like them. And number one, virtually no one turns them off. And like, it's easy. It's not an option that's hidden away somewhere. It's a close button on the actual ad, right? Less than 1% of people do that. Number two, the click-through rate is actually higher than average. Right, and it seems contradictory at the start, but when you think about it a bit more, on a page where we have an ad, there's nothing else there, right? We don't need to shout. That's great for us, right? We can have a polite ad, and it works. We don't need to be aggressive. But we're not competing with any other ad on the page. We're just saying, and here's like a message from the sponsor, or here's a link to the product that this thing is giving a positive review to, so you can buy it. You know, it's that kind of stuff, and it's working really well.
Or quite also, likely as well. It's not just you're the only ad on the page, you're probably the only ad the person might have seen for quite some time.
Yeah.
It happens to be one of that 1,100 companies the person has now landed on, and the rest of the day they spent completely ad-free. You may well be the only ads they see all day.
Yeah. So ad blockers aren't banner blind, is the phrase people use in the ad industry, but basically haven't trained themselves to ignore the ads because they have software that does that for them. But that's one way of looking at it. I like to think that we're just doing a good job of not being offensive, being polite and being relevant.
I think a lot of people got very annoyed with ads. I mean, I used to look at a local news site here, and a sort of scrolling dancing woman used to go across my screen when I was using Internet Explorer because I was doing some testing. And I was at the office, so it didn't matter with regard to bandwidth and time necessarily, but as a home user, that's all expensive. with your ad blocking tools, I presume that resolves a lot of it because you're, again, very, very small. Is it just text, or do you also include images, or can you customize it for the end company?
Yeah, so for the most part, it's just text at the moment. That we put it back in the same spaces where the banners used to be. We got some ads running that have images in them, but they're small. So it's a mixture of images and text. For instance, ads that recommend products related to the content. There's a little thumbnail of the actual product in them, right? So yeah, once again, just a JPEG though, no flash or anything, nothing that jumps around. And then the websites using us can do a degree of customization. And we intend to increase that. So basically, you know, the ads can be made blend in with the user experience a bit more and not make the site look crappy. And I think, the whole advertising industry that's out there is just basically, it's cannibalizing itself, right? All the ads are ugly. They are all about breaking the user experience. That cheapens the brand that the publisher has, probably in many cases spent so many years to build up. It cheapens it erodes the loyalty between the publisher and the audience that they've worked so hard to bring to their website. I mean, it's all terrible. Most existing advertising just erodes the only thing of value in the equation, which is the relationship between the publisher and its audience. So we're just really trying to redefine that by being really polite, very different. And we have the luxury of doing that because we're not competing against anyone else. When our ads aren't on the page, that's it. There's no other ads on the page.
So are the companies that are coming to you, are they choosing to use your unintrusive ads when there's an ad blocker, or are they choosing to use them more broadly now?
So at the moment, it's just when there's an ad blocker.
So they will still put up the big flashing banner for everyone otherwise.
I see. Yeah, so it's from one point of view, you could say that it's ad block appropriate advertising, right? We're saying, hey, you're an advertiser, that's cool. Like, have this instead. We're going to be polite to you. But from PageFair's point of view, I want to take this opportunity to show that it actually works to respect your audience, right? And actually just demonstrate that with ad blockers and show, look, even the ad blockers don't opt out of this, you know, and they do click on it and they seem to get value from it and they don't complain. And in fact, they click the upvote button on the ads, right? That's what we want to take the opportunity to prove, and then go back to every publisher and say, just turn us on for the whole thing, you know, because this allows you, maybe there's some trashy ad you could run today that might make you more money in the next week, right? By selling something spammy. But that's also going to annoy your own audience sufficiently. You're going to lose a whole bunch of the capital you've built up in your business, that kind of loyalty capital you've built up in your business with your audience. So we want to be able to prove this out and go to publishers and say, look, you know, invest, do this because it's better for your business in the long run.
But if they go down that route, will they need PageFair anymore if they go down the route of just supplying nothing but unintrusive ads?
If we get to that point, it looks like we will. It'll take a few years. If we get to that point, PageFair's main differentiator is that we'll be the only place in the world you can go to for ads that don't suck. Because really, everyone else's ads are all about how loud can you shout. How loud can you shout at the user? That's how everyone else is competing. You know, even when you look at the IAB, which is the standards body for ads, they have, if you go to their website, they talk about their innovative new ad formats, the rising stars, right? And what these are banners bigger than normal banners that are animated, and the ones that roll down on the website when you accidentally mouse over them and stuff. This is innovation in the ad industry, right? I mean, it's unique for us to be actually saying we're innovating by having quiet ads. And we have the space to be able to prove that that's going to work well, because it's just ad blockers, right?
But surely, as companies see that this is becoming the norm, advertising companies will begin to move towards that, I would imagine.
Well, you know, I think, you know, we're beginning to see some competition coming up against PageFair now. And that's cool, because it was getting a little bit lonely. but we have a head start, so I think we'll get there. But the existing big ad companies... do you know The Innovator's Dilemma?
No. Nope.
Ray Christensen's book. So, you know, the whole idea of disrupting technologies and stuff, that comes from that book. And it's amazing. Let me really recommend it. Life-changing book. I wish I read this at the start of my career, right? It gives you a framework for looking at entire markets and figuring out how technology is going to cut into that market and where you want to be standing when it happens.
So just give the title and the author again, please.
The Innovator's Dilemma by Clay Christensen.
Thank you.
And that's amazing. It's pretty tough going, right? I was glad I have an engineering background reading that book on companies and marketing. It was dense, but incredible, right? A disruptive technology, right, has an interesting spin in it. The incumbents in a market, right, the big companies, right, they've got existing clients and they need to do well by their existing clients. Disruptive technologies are technologies that those big companies can't sell to their current big clients. Therefore, they can't really. You know, they can't really turn their businesses around to work on those things. And a small company is always going to come up from the bottom and eat their lunch or eat into that market overall as the disruptive technology becomes cheaper and faster and so on. So the young small company gets to develop expertise in the new technology for a few years and be able to deploy that against the big company when that technology becomes cheap and fast. So that's what that book is about. It's fascinating. And it has lots of real examples of real industries, particularly disk drives, and how it happened about five times in the storage industry, which are really accessible. Right. So in this case, it's a similar thing, right? The advertising companies, I don't think they can pivot around and say, you know what, we're going to start doing really, really quiet, respectful ads because they're currently competing against each other and they're competing on how loud the ads are. Right, because you go to any web page and it's going to have seven different ads in it from seven different companies, and they're all trying to get the click. Right, it's a losing game for any of those guys to be the quiet one. They can't do it. Right, so I don't think the existing companies can really do that. Even in terms of their organizations, they can't. From talking to some of the bigger companies now, I found an interesting analogy. Right. When I was back at that PhD in Trinity College, I was doing peer-to-peer software, right, to try and help people share music without getting caught. Political free speech is what I call it, I think.
Peer-to-peer, anonymous peer-to-peer file sharing for whatever purpose the person deemed fit.
Free speech. And we all saw Napster happen, right? And how did the music industry respond to Napster, right? We tried to sue the bejesus out of everyone, like kids, grannies, everyone. Right, shut it down, pretend it's not going to happen. Right, it's the only response that they felt was available to them. And to a large degree, it's still happening. Right, the right answer was probably to try and work with Napster and launch iTunes. Right, but that's not what happened with Napster. Right, I think it feels like something similar is going to happen here. The big advertising companies, they look at ad blockers and their response is, you know what? Those people should go to jail. Right, they're pirating stuff. Right, they're pirating our revenues, right? They should be shut down, right? And that's basically, if you're in a big company that's successful in advertising, the culture in that company is going to say that. And how can a company like that really do anything constructive, right?
I've seen it myself. You're right. It comes down to culture. There was a company I worked in, which was a big job posting company. So it was classified ads for jobs. And all of us engineers were looking, going, you know what, actually job networking is now the way to go in a particular job networking site. But it wouldn't rise above the level of, you know, head of engineering from the CEO on down. It was job posting is the truth. That's the way. Networking is rubbish. We don't need it, until it was too late. And by the time I left that company, the job networking site, I think, had a market cap about 15 or 20 times the size of the job posting site, and it's obviously dominant. You can probably figure out who I'm talking about. I imagine you're probably right. It's very hard for a company, because I think what often happens is that the head, the board, the CEO have what they want, and if you as a CTO don't agree, they'll replace you. And I've seen that happen in companies too.
And it's more vertical than that as well, right? It's the board, the CEO, the cloud of people around the CEO, the step below CTO, all the people from the CTO down. Every rule the entire company works on all the values, you know, I think it was in the innovator's dilemma as well that it took this apart. Companies comprise of values, which are how the relationships between every unit, every person in the company is governed, right? And the culture is like the sum effect of that organism in operation. You can't just go in and redefine all of those values to basically have this emergent effect of a different culture, you know, on any reasonable time frame. You just can't disassemble a company and put it back together again like that. It's too complicated.
One area I wanted to ask you about was mobile, though. Ad blockers are not as popular on mobile, I imagine.
No. So I think it's more of a practicality right now, and maybe one or two interesting other things. You can do it. You can install on Android mobile Firefox or Firefox for Android.
I've done it this week.
Yeah, you can install AdBlock Plus from there. It supports extensions. But the default Chrome browser for Android and Safari for iOS do not support extensions. I wonder why, right?
But I don't think Opera does either, to be fair.
Okay.
But yes, I wonder why too.
Yeah.
With regard to Chrome.
There's an AdBlock for iOS browser you can install. But on iOS, you can't replace the default browser. A link you click will still open by default in Safari, as I understand it. So it's a little bit hard to basically for just to exclusively use a different browser that you installed. Now, what's next? There's some things afoot. The AdBlock plugins are hard at work creating Android and iOS AdBlock browsers. Right?
Browsers.
So they're AdBlockers, but there are special browsers that feature AdBlocking as a built-in thing. The other approach to go with is an actual AdBlock app. You can install AdBlock Plus for Android, but it's not approved. Google unapproved it because
they took it off the store, didn't they, a few months back?
Yeah, I think it was maybe even last year. Felt a little bit like it was a technicality, but maybe it's fair enough, right? Basically, it was looking at the traffic running through the phone, and it would block things going to ad servers, right? So it was tampering. It was blocked for tampering with a third-party application. So it's basically acting like a firewall, right? So I don't know. There's a bit of debate over that, but, you know, Google owns the Play Store, so its decision is final. So that's another way you can go. You can still install it off-market if you like.
I did that, but I think, am I right in saying it only worked on Wi-Fi?
I don't recall. I thought it worked everywhere, but
I thought it did, and then because of that, I just said that's not really good enough, and I removed it.
It didn't get widely used in the end, anyway.
No, I think once you kind of take it out of the store, then you're into the whole. You shouldn't sideload stuff for fear of viruses and whatever else.
Disconnect is another plugin, right? Disconnect blocks third-party trackers. It's not about blocking ads. It's about blocking things that are tracking you on the internet. And dear Lord, it's a scary situation when you actually learn how many things are tracking you on the internet, like we have over the last 2 years. That's what they do. They incidentally block ads when they're blocking the tracking an awful lot of the time. And they released a version for Android recently. I think I saw it in the news. And that got blocked, that got banned as well in a similar way. And I don't know. I think we have to watch the space with iOS. You know, would a similar app for iOS get blocked? What would Apple's policy be on that?
So is Disconnect something like Ghostery for Firefox?
Yeah, it's similar to Ghostery.
Yeah, I've installed, like I said, I've installed Firefox on Android, I've installed my ad blocker, and I've installed Ghostery.
Yeah.
So at the moment, that is the kind of the only option you have, Firefox? If you want to block ads on mobile, you pretty much have to go with Firefox.
Yes, that's pretty much it. Yeah, but it's going to change. And I think when you think you stand back and look at it and say, let's assume that the major AdBlock plugins create browsers, like AdBlock browsers that you can install, right? Just apps. And then they use their market share with desktop to promote the fact that, hey, did you know you can block ads on your mobile as well? Right? And they put that message up in front of 150, 200 million avid users that they have in the world today, right? And they have the unique opportunity to advertise to these people by basically updating their plugins and having a new home screen or something saying, hey, try our mobile version, right? It would get a lot of purchase. If people tell each other about ad blocking by word of mouth. So once it's got enough market share, it'll just grow exponentially.
But don't a lot of these, let's say, free products like Firefox and let's say Ubuntu and Linux Mint, they rely to a certain degree on paid for ads being presented to users to support their development?
Let's see. Yeah. Well, a lot of companies do.
No, but I mean, so I would imagine I use Linux Mint quite a bit, and they encourage you to use one particular search engine, which will contribute a very small percentage of any ad revenue to the further development. But then if they start promoting ad blocking, it will negatively affect them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the AdBlock plugins can promote themselves.
Yep.
So they can basically promote themselves from the plugin in the browsers and ask people to go install it on mobile. And I think that would work.
Yep.
And an AdBlock plugin on mobile can potentially save your battery life, improve the usage of your screen real estate, and save you on data.
Yeah, that becomes a big issue. You're talking about speed, power, long lasting, and you know you are paying for this. You're in the US or anywhere, you're paying quite a high fee for your 3 or 4G connection. You don't really want it being used up by something that you have no interest in the first place.
Yeah. So the scary thing is that there's people, all kinds of people, working on putting ad blocking onto mobile right now, and the conditions might be right for it to be a killer app.
What do you make of the argument that companies make, you know, well, you're partaking in our free website, our website with free content, therefore you must or should look at our ads?
I think that sometime in the mid-90s, someone made a terrible mistake and decided that websites were going to be primarily funded by ads instead of, you know, any kind of paid model. The problem with paid models is that there just isn't a good payment infrastructure to support this at the moment, right? There's no way to really pay for reading a page of content on the web, right? The economics of that don't work, right, at the moment. But anyway, the problem with advertising revenue models is that there's a contract between the publisher and the advertiser. There's no contract between the reader and the publisher. So the publisher might look at it, and a lot of publishers look at it and say, this is piracy. These people are literally taking our revenue away, right? And they try to react to it like it's piracy, right? But, you know, the user, like, wasn't paying for anything anyway. That wasn't how it worked, and there was never any actual contract in place with the user, right? This is, I mean, I think that that's at the core of it, right? Most users, when they install AdBlock, aren't even thinking about the effect it's going to have, because they never had to think about that kind of stuff, right? So it's very tough for the websites to go out to the users and say, hey, you're killing us here, right? Because the users just don't think about that stuff. I think it's a shame, because it's true, right? It costs a lot of money to make content. There's a lot of crap websites out there, right, with crap ads. So let's put those aside. But, you know, the web, I mean, what's the future of the Fifth Estate? You know, the whole concept of investigative journalism in the world, you know? Or, you know, I mean, where does it go? What happens? It's like there's zero value attached right now to original content, purely because people are growing up with it being free, and they're just not part of the transaction that happens around financing that contract. That content.
I think a lot of people would argue that the Fifth Estate has been failing for quite some time, irrespective of web content ads being displayed or not. You know, if you look at the likes of the news networks here in the US or the free-to-air channels, it's questionable whether they're really living up to the sort of the agreement that they would provide investigative journalism, good news for the getting the free bandwidth of the airspace.
This is part one of a two-part interview with Sean Blanchfield of Pagefair. In this part, we discuss non-technical aspects, such as Sean's background, the history of Pagefair, what ad blocking is, how it has grown, and then in part two, we discuss Pagefair's technical architecture and their ad exchange. That's the end of part one of my interview with Sean of Pagefair. In part two, we discuss more of the technical aspects of how they solved various problems, scalability, bidding, speed, and so on.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Noon by Lukai from the album Circuits Imprimes Volume 3.